Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Front Line.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 30th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Why live to tape? Well, folks, happy Memorial Day. It is a Memorial Day today. We are off, but we still, as we do always, are providing you with fresh content. I don't want to say always because I can't speak to the future. Maybe tomorrow we won't. We probably will, but I'm just saying I don't want to lock myself in. Just about every day now, or every weekday for the past 7-8 months, the Majority Report has brought you new, fresh content. And today is no different. On the program with me today, from a Ring of Fire interview I did last week, Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America, by author Joe Burns. It is an important... It's an important prescription for what we need to do in this country. We've been talking a lot more about direct action and about the idea of strengthening unions. And I think Joe Burns has it right. It's a fascinating book. I recommend it to you all highly. Have a great Memorial Day. Listen to this. Enjoy your time with your family, your friends, if you have either. And if you don't, why not go back and check out some of the archives? There are some shows from the beginning I know that you missed, that you probably regret doing so. Early on, we had some very interesting loose shows. Go back and check it out. Like I said on Friday, take time to just think about the people that have given up their lives to protect our American values. And think about what those values are. And just in many respects, how far we have strayed from those values. All right, folks, here's Joe Burns, and we will see you tomorrow, or hear you tomorrow, as it were. Okay, have a great weekend, or have a great Monday, I should say. See you tomorrow. Joining me now is Joe Burns, an attorney and author of the new book, Reviving the Strike, who says that American workers must unite together behind unions in order to preserve the protections that unions have been fighting for years. So, Joe, I think your book, Reviving the Strike, is obviously incredibly timely, even more so because of what's been taking place over the last months across the country as the rights of unions to collectively bargain are being attacked across the country. And there seems to be more direct action that is taking place. But give us a sense. Let's back up and just give us a sense of where we are in terms of the rights of workers to strike at this point, and where we have been.
The right to strike has been seriously eroded in this country. Originally, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed in the 1930s, it was intended to guarantee the right to strike. After 80 years of legislation and judicial decisions, this right has been seriously eroded so that today workers wanting to strike are forced to fight with their hands tied behind their back. They're not able to use the traditional tools of the labor movement, which was solidarity, and they're not allowed to engage in an effective strike. On the other hand, the employer can legally give away their jobs at the end of a failed strike by permanently replacing them, and has lots of other tools available to dissuade workers from striking.
So let's go back even further. Before the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, what was the playing field? I mean, obviously the government essentially creates the legal entity that is a corporation. It allows it to organize. It provides some legal structure for its reporting and to have shareholders, and it provides all sorts of benefits in terms of infrastructure from which corporations do business. What was it before 1935 in terms of what the government did to provide some form of level playing field before 1935?
Well, prior to 1935, the entire field of labor relations was pretty much unregulated. So what you had is a series of judicial decisions attacking the right to strike. But on the other hand, you had trade unions who upheld as a matter of principle their right to strike. So what you saw in the 1910s and the 1920s and in the 1930s was workers striking together industry-wide. And they were able to engage in successful strikes in the 1930s, even at the height of the Great Depression with unemployment in double digits. And that's because workers back there understood that they needed to have the right not only to a strike, but to an effective strike.
I presume at that point there was no protections in terms of whether or not they could be fired. There was no government support in any way for that right to strike. It was simply something that workers took upon themselves.
The process of forming a union was something that was internal to the workers themselves. They got together, and if enough of them decided to band together, then they had a union. And if the employer engaged in repression against them, then it was a matter of their strength. If they were strong enough and the employer fired someone, then perhaps they would all go out on strike together. But workers took it upon themselves to defend their rights.
Okay, so now tell me about the nature of strikes that take place today. They're very narrow, aren't they?
Yeah, today strikes are very narrow, and a lot of that is due to the restrictions in the legal system today. But let's say a worker strikes at a meatpacking plant. In the 1940s and 50s, they would have been going out on strike with pretty much everyone in the meatpacking industry, so maybe 300,000-400,000 workers together. Today, workers...
Now, that's known as a secondary strike. Is that right?
It's known as an industry strike, and it could also be a secondary strike. A secondary strike is when you strike a related employer.
Okay. Well, let's get to that in a minute. So you'd have at that time in the 50s, if there's one company in the meatpacking business that workers chose to strike, workers across that industry would strike.
Yeah, they did industry-wide strikes. So, for example, 500,000 steel workers struck in 1959 for 116 days. And when you strike together, you obviously have a lot more power, and you have a lot more political impact. In contrast, today, we can take a strike, let's say, at Hormel in the mid-80s. Workers were forced to strike at one plant of a giant corporation. Now, obviously, that's very isolating, and it's hard to have economic impact upon an employer when you're only hitting one profit center of that employer.
We have a situation where they're limited in that respect. Why are they limited in that respect? Is that an active decision on their part? Or
it's basically as a result of both legislation and as a result of judicial decisions. Legislatively, trade unions' use of certain tactics was outlawed in 1947 as part of the Taft-Hartley Act. So secondary strikes, which we mentioned briefly before, and certain types of industry-wide strikes were made illegal. And then a series of court decisions narrowed the bargaining even further and made the participation in industry-wide bargaining completely voluntary on behalf of the employer.
What was the legal justification? The ideological justification for Taft-Hartley? I mean, you're basically saying that it's illegal for workers to strike across an industry. What's the argument there?
Well, I think basically it's always boiled down to effectiveness. And employers have long understood something perhaps even better than trade unionists, that if they win a strike, they only win that strike. But if they are able to change the rules of the game in their favor, they can win strike after strike. So in the 1940s, there was a huge battle when they attempted to pass Taft-Hartley, and trade unionists at the time predicted it would spell the demise of the labor movement. They were correct. It just took a little bit longer than they had anticipated. So in terms of the justification, I think you see it happening today where employers with the Boeing case are attacking the National Labor Relations Board for issuing a fairly routine legal decision that says, hey, employer, you cannot threaten and actually move production just because your workers exercise their legal right to strike up in Seattle. So what happened is they moved the production of a Boeing aircraft down to South Carolina.
We got to take a break in just a moment, but before we do, just set the table again for us. What is a secondary strike?
A secondary strike would be where, let's say, I'm a brewery workers union producing beer, and we go on strike. Well, in order to maximize our effect, let's say we set up picket lines at some neighborhood bars, and we ask the bartenders to go out on strike in support of our strike. That's a second. The strike of the bartenders would be a secondary strike because they would be doing it in support of other workers.
And that has been and that is banned as well by Taft-Hartley, isn't it?
Yeah, that was one of the key provisions of Taft-Hartley was to ban them. And that's really the secondary strike was basically very useful in industries with a lot of small employers such as trucking. And that's basically how the Teamsters were able to organize hundreds of thousands of workers into a master contract and provide a great way of life for a whole generation of workers.
All right, well, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about some examples of strikes in the more modern era and just who's responsible for the weakening of unions. And we'll deal with that when we come back. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with attorney Joe Burns, author of the new book, Reviving the Strike, about the importance of labor unions in America. So, Joe, we were talking about the situation that unions were left in after the passage of Taft-Hartley back in 47 and the slow demise of the power of unions because of banning of things like industry-wide strikes, of secondary strikes, ones that allowed unions to actually get more strength out from outside their specific unions, ones that actually, I guess, would you describe it as emboldening and empowering workers as opposed to just unions?
Oh, precisely. I mean, the strike is an essential element of workers having a say on the job. So it really does, the strike really does power and transform working people.
The demise of the power of unions is attributable to, I think, to many things. And we've talked about the sort of the legal narrowing of unions' powers. But there's been other factors, too. Could you talk about those?
Well, I think one of the main things has been not only a change in the legal rules, but a change in trade unionists' own way of thinking. I think we have, over the last several decades, forgotten what the true source of power is for unions and have embraced a variety of strategies which do not include the strike, which for 150 years was the centerpiece of trade union strategy. So I think if you look back, trade unionists of yesterday, of years past, would look in disbelief that we could even think of having a trade union movement that wasn't based on the strike.
What are the trade unions? What are they basing it on now? I mean, are we looking at a failure of leadership? Are we looking at unions that were too focused on what was good for their unions, specifically their unions? Are we looking at short-sightedness? Are we looking at unions that have become less adversarial to their own detriment with corporations? Take us through that.
Sure. What you see is, since the 1980s, many unions did go on strike during the 1980s, but unlike the 1930s, they chose to follow a set of rules that clearly were set up for trade unions to lose. So they would strike, put up a picket line, and people would be permanently replaced, and eventually the strike would be lost. So in response to that, the theory developed that, well, we should really focus on organizing the unorganized. So massive amounts of union resources were put into that over the last decade and a half. For example, the service employees put in $1.3 billion from 1995 to 2006. And they had very little to show to that, basically because it doesn't address the key problem facing the trade union movement, which is our lack of economic strength. Trade unions must be able to improve workers' lives. So part of what I'm trying to do with this book is to argue that the union movement needs to refocus on strategies that are actually capable of improving workers' lives. And to do that, we're going to need to redevelop the strike, and not the weak strike of the 1980s, but something that looks a lot more like the traditional strikes of the 1930s through the 1960s.
Well, how do you go about doing that? I mean, I'm pretty stunned that a union spent $1 billion in trying to increase the size of its union, and you're suggesting that, A, they didn't increase it enough, but, B, what they really should have been doing is strengthening the will of the members of the union and their ability to sustain a strike, as opposed to increasing their numbers. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, precisely. We need to develop forms of trade unionism and forms of economic activity that can win. And we have examples in the last several decades of when unions have tried that. And we need a lot more of it. And
tell us some of those examples.
Okay. One example was the Pittston strike, which was led by Rich Trumka, who's now the AFL-CIO president, but back then he was head of the Mine Workers Union. And in 1989-90, they engaged in a prolonged battle against the Pittston Coal Company. And unlike many of the strikes during the 1980s, they really focused on grassroots activism, solidarity, and militancy. And they undertook actions such as having mine workers in camouflage doing a symbolic takeover of one of the mines. They had supporters come in and they sat down and did civil disobedience in the roads. They put a tremendous amount of effort into it, but it was one of the few strike victories during that period. More recently, I think you can see with the Republic Windows in Chicago back in 2008, when the employer decided to attempt to shut down the plant in the middle of the night and move equipment, workers represented by the United Electrical Workers engaged in a plant occupation, and it really galvanized the nation. And they eventually forced the banks, who were the money players behind it, to put in money to provide severance for those workers. So those are just a couple examples of where workers have relied on bold actions, and they have gotten some good results for that.
So do you think that to a certain extent that the leadership of unions in some ways have joined the very class that they used to be adversarial with? In other words, is there too much risk involved for union leadership in some instances? Because I ask this because I'm thinking about Wisconsin. And there was a time back in late February, early March, where there was a lot of talk of a general strike, something that we just don't see. And in some ways, that energy was co-opted for electoral purposes. And the idea of that type of direct action just seemed to, I guess, just dissolve.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressures against unions as institutions. And the legal system is set up so that unions who engage in more, let's say, militant actions or illegal actions have a lot of consequences against them. So what you saw during the Pittston strike, which I talked about, eventually a federal judge issued $65 million in fines against the unions, against the United Mine Workers. That went up to the Supreme Court and eventually was thrown out on procedural grounds, but that's a tremendous disincentive for unions to engage in the type of actions they need to do. That's why in part of my argument in the book is that we have to look at new forms of unionization, perhaps creating new unions from scratch that don't have assets and don't have those institutional concerns. They could have the support of the labor movement, but I think we have to start trying to work around what are the impediments to having an effective strike and put our main focus there.
So you're saying that in some respects the assets and the power that unions have built has become a liability in some sense because there's too much for the institution to lose, whereas it used to be just a function of what the workers need.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, there are real constraints upon unions, and some of them are legitimate, but as one theorist stated, at the end of the day, maybe we'll save our buildings and our assets, but we won't be representing any workers, and we won't be fulfilling our historic mission. So we really need to find a new way of doing things, and I think we can learn a lot from Wisconsin. As you pointed out, the battle in Wisconsin had a very grassroots character, and it was an upsurge of working people that was largely, independent of formal trade union support. So you saw workers showing up on their own with their homemade printed signs and just coming in droves to be at the Capitol. And that's what's really going to revive the labor movement.
I think that's a great point. Joe Burns, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
Joe Burns is a union negotiator and attorney and also the author of the forthcoming book, Revival of the Strike and the Future of American Labor. You can find more information online at revivingthestrike.org. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light. Somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah.